Imperial program. You are cleared for departure. Have a good flight.
The Christopher Gabriel program begins now.
Your 50,000 watt sports leader in Fresno, the Central Valley, and for Giants fans wondering if yesterday's game is still going on right now. It might be. 940 ESPN, 940 ESPN, Fresno.com. Your 2 hour tour begins right now, 4 minutes, 41 seconds past the hour of 7 a.m. Pacific Daylight Saving Time. I am the host of this program, and none other that I am aware of, Christopher Gabriel. Good morning to you. Another beautiful morning here in the Central Valley of California. I hope it's equally gorgeous wherever you happen to be waking up, or you're already starting your workday, or have started your workday out on the East Coast or somewhere in the Midwest. Technical director, producer, hockey guy, Sharks fan, Giants fan, Russ, keeping us moving in the right direction. On the program today, our weekly encore, bottom of the hour, the voice of the Visalia Rawhide. Visited us a little bit earlier this week. Fascinating young lady, Jill Guerin. Sets 7:35. 8:05, Bob Busser, one of the nation's preeminent ballpark, stadium, and arena photographers and historians. Bob was supposed to visit us yesterday, but the Giants game went into extra innings, and we had to pretty much clear the decks of everybody yesterday except for Coach Q, who made it in for about 20 minutes at the end of the program. But Mr. Busser is back. Bob joins me at 8:05. If you've never heard Bob, he's a fascinating listen. His work is really remarkable. He's the 2019 Tony Salen Memorial Award recipient. That is given out by the Baseball Reliquary, the Board of Directors of the Baseball Reliquary. They announced that Bob's the winner of that award this year, and that's going to be given to him on July 14th down in Pasadena. And it was established 17 years ago to recognize individuals for their commitment to the preservation of baseball history. And it should be noted, I said stadiums, I said arenas. Bob's work goes much further than just baseball parks. But he's always fun to have on the program. And I'm sure we'll chat a little food with Bob as well. At 8:35, our weekly visit from Nick Shager, Daily Beast, Variety, Yahoo Movies and Esquire, one wonderful film critic, lots of stuff to share with you. We're also going to talk a little bit about the finale of Game of Thrones. I didn't watch it. I didn't watch the whole series. But it's certainly not lost on me the fact that you folks who did watch it, you were not happy with the ending. And so he's not as unhappy. So we'll find out from Nick what the deal with that is. Aladdin opens this weekend. And also there's a pretty darn good baseball documentary that goes well beyond baseball that's coming out this weekend as well. And anytime we have a chance to get sports movies under, we always do. It's called The Spy Behind Home Plate. It's a documentary about Mo Berg. He was a player with the White Sox, Indians, and Red Sox, and he quite a character. But baseball doesn't begin to tell his whole story. If you know the story, you know what I'm talking about. But Nick will roll that out at about 8:35. All right, do you have your coffee? Maybe munching on some bacon or some eggs, waffles, maybe some pancakes or a bowl of cereal. I want to tell you a story, and it's a brief story, but I want to tell you a story nonetheless. And I'm going to bury part of the lead, but not the whole part of the lead. This story is about UCLA and USC, but more specifically, St. Thomas University, St. Thomas University in Minnesota, in Minneapolis. And I'm going to start by taking you back to a 12-year period for the UCLA Bruins. 1963 to sports seasons starting 1963 through 1974-75. In basketball, that was the time that John Wooden lit up the entire country. Nobody was really beating UCLA. Oh, they lost their games, but that was the period of time that UCLA won 10 national championships in those 12 years. And the overall record for UCLA playing in the then Pac-8 in those 12 years was 335 wins against only 22 losses. 335 and 22. In that time, overall, UCLA, in that 12-year period, they won 29 national championships. The only other school that compared to them was their friends across town, USC. USC, in that same time frame, won 28 national championships. The only difference between SC and UCLA at the time is that SC's championships were coming, they were a dominant power in baseball, in tennis, in track and field, and they would win four in a row, five in a row, maybe 6 in 8 years. But SC didn't have a sport that they won 10 in 12 years, including 7 in a row at one point, as UCLA did in basketball, winning 7 in a row from the 66-67 season through the 72-73 season. And you look at the dominance of that team, and they had those UCLA teams back in those days, they had 7 undefeated seasons. It was ridiculous. You know, within that time frame, that was when they had their 88-game winning streak. So the Pac-8, as it was back then, SC and UCLA, Stanford and Cal, Oregon State, Washington State, it's reasonable to assume that, at least regarding basketball, there were probably some, if not more than a few, athletic directors or college presidents in the Pac-8 that would have really welcomed UCLA being anywhere but the Pacific 8 Conference, because nobody could beat them. Nobody could beat them. They dominated everybody, not only in the Pac-8 but across the nation. But obviously, you're not going to just remove a team from a conference because they're better than you, not only in one sport but pretty much every other sport as well. Because I think, you know, imagining the conference back then, I think the conference probably understood we're still better with them than not having them. There was a time in the Southeastern Conference that there was talk of Vanderbilt getting removed from the conference because they simply weren't able to stay at the same level as the other schools, but that was in football. They've always been competitive in basketball. I believe they won a national championship in baseball, and they're the best academic school in the Southeastern Conference and one of the best academic schools in the nation, and they're one of the original members of the SEC, and reasonable heads prevailed. Well, this leads me to St. Thomas, who many of you listening to me right now probably have never heard of until I just mentioned it. But they are a Division III football powerhouse that plays in the Minnesota Intercollegiate Athletic Conference. No, it's known as the MIAC, M-I-A-C. And the conference itself, the conference itself for football has 9 teams in it. Overall, the conference has 13 teams. But relative to football, that is where St. Thomas plays, and that's where they're going to continue to play until the spring of 2021, and I mean that in all sports, because they have been involuntarily removed from the Minnesota Intercollegiate Athletic Conference. This was just a stunning 94-word press release, just a couple of sentences saying that they have officially booted them out of the conference. And the problem here, according to the conference, from the MIAC President's Council, they cited athletic competitive parity as the primary concern. And so St. Thomas is going to begin a multi-year transition immediately They're still eligible to compete as a full member of the MEAC, but again, that'll go through the spring of 2021, and then they're left through then to find a new conference, or perhaps to find, not necessarily to find a Division III conference, maybe to move up to Division II. Now, why did this happen? Well, they've had some frustrations with the Tommies. In 11 years in football, the past 11, this 11-year period, that's why I use the 12-year period for UCLA and for USC. In an 11-year period ending this year, they have gone 118-19 under head coach Glenn Caruso. In six of those years, they went undefeated in conference play. Last year, St. Thomas outscored their conference opponents 357-96, or roughly 45-12. All right, they scored at least 60 points in conference games, in MEAC games, four times, and they also posted four shutouts. You want to go back to the 2017 season, they played St. Olaf. It's a very Minnesota name. St. Olaf, they beat them 97-0. Sounds like an old Steve Spurrier score. They also have the Learfield Directors Cup. They won the 2017-2018 Cup by over 250 points. Now, this is something that the conference members, it wasn't so much the conference members came out and went after them. It was, again, the President's Council that decided they're just too good for us. And, is it enrollment? Well, their enrollment is 6,100 and change. And it's larger than most every other university in the conference. There's schools in that conference like Bethel, Gustavus, Concordia, Carleton. These are all smaller schools in Minnesota, Augsburg. If you're in the Midwest, you're familiar with these schools. But enrollment was part of the decision. And they're one of the founding members. They're one of the founding members of this conference. But as this decision came down, as this decision was handed down, what's notable about this is that nobody is talking. Not one president from any other school in the conference has come out publicly and said a word. Not a word. The only school talking, the only president talking, as you might imagine, and they are largely controlling the narrative here, is Julie Sullivan. She is the president of St. Thomas. And she issued a statement. It was just hours after the decision from the MEAC to remove them from the conference over a three-year period. And as you would imagine, they're very disappointed. But everybody else has essentially buried their heads in the sand on this. And they just want this to kind of go away, and that'll be that. So it begs a number of questions here. Number one, what kind of precedent is being set here by little St. Thomas, little 6,000-person St. Thomas University? How can a conference find it reasonable to kick out a conference member because they're too good? And that's why I started this with UCLA, because there's never been a 10, 11, 12-year period. I'm talking about the major sports. I'm not talking about soccer, with all due respect to the Olympic sports, as they're called now. I'm not talking about soccer or volleyball or swimming and diving. I'm talking about the major sports. We can agree the three major sports at the collegiate level, for the most part, are football, men's basketball, and baseball. Those are the dominant three sports. And that's why, again, I started with UCLA, because there's never been a college more dominant than UCLA in their 10 years out of 12 years winning NCAA titles. And the record that they amassed in those 12 years, 335 wins, 22 losses, 10 national championships, and the university as a whole, 29 titles. But nobody in the Pac-8 imagined ever giving them away. Giving them out of the, removing them from the conference. How can a conference do this and actually look themselves in the mirror collectively and say, we did a good thing today? The fact that the other teams in this conference, Bethel, in terms of football, we'll just start with football. Bethel, St. John's You may not be familiar with St. John's. St. John's is the only school in this conference that's actually won a Division III national championship. And St. John's, under legendary coach John Gagliardi, ESPN's done numerous features on him. They were a powerhouse. They used to beat St. Thomas regularly. There was a period of time they beat him 12 years in a row. But the other schools in this conference, St. John's, Bethel, Gustavus Concordia, St. Olaf, Carleton, Hamline, Augsburg, the fact that they have not been able to compete with St. Thomas, whatever happened to, how about doing better? Go out and do a better job recruiting. No, you're not giving scholarships out. A lot of players on these teams are walk-ons. They're recruiting, but they're finding ways around it. There's going to be academic scholarships. They're going to figure out ways to get grants. There's all kinds of ways they can relieve some of the pressure and to entice athletes to come to a Division III school. But this is the weasel's way out. Poor us. St. Thomas is too good for the rest of us, for the rest of the schools, so we're going to get rid of them. And not one school stood up for St. Thomas. And that's why I find it just reprehensible that the other presidents and athletic directors have stayed silent. Because they're delighted. Because they haven't been good enough. They've done a less than satisfactory job of recruiting or putting teams on the field. And granted, sports results aren't the be-all, end-all, but let's not kid each other. You're playing sports at the collegiate level, whether it's Division I, II, or III, to win. Anybody, you know, you get into academic circles sometimes, and you'll hear some academics say, well, I think too much emphasis is put on football. You'll hear that from P5 schools, the head of the physiology department or the communications department or what have you. I used to hear this when I was at USC, and I just thought, please don't be hypocritical. USC football is practically funding USC at the time. And you look at what sports at the major levels, what they do, and how they're able to fund a new building, a new library, a new dormitory, whatever the case may be. We'll damn the school for putting an emphasis on putting winning football and basketball teams out there, but we'll very quietly accept that check and then cut the ribbon on the new building. So, the hypocritical nature is alive and well in colleges. So there are some who will say in the MEAC, there are some in that conference who will say, well, we've put too much emphasis on sports to begin with. So it's probably good because they've raised the bar a little bit too much and we're putting too much emphasis. That's nonsense. If one school has dominated, like UConn women's basketball for years, dominated the Big East. They're just dominated. Get better. Tennessee women's basketball, Pat Summitt, dominated the SEC. UCLA men's basketball, dominated. USC baseball, dominated the Pac-8. Get better. You don't remove a school. So going forward, how many conferences? I don't think we're going to see this happen in a P5 or Group of Five conference, but conferences that have seen them do this and now do it successfully. St. Thomas, they fought this, but they weren't going to win, and they knew they weren't going to win. How many conferences will look at a member, maybe a Division II conference or another Division III conference, and say, you know, these guys have been winning a lot. They've been winning an awful lot. They've won just so much in basketball. We need to get rid of them. And essentially have a coup and get rid of them. Because the rest of the schools can't field good enough teams or find good enough coaches. I just thought, you know, again, I think it's a sad day in sports when you get rid of a school because they've done too well. And I've always thought that a conference that has a dominant team, a dominant program in one sport, is better for the conference than just removing them. You're better when you have a strong school because things go in cycles. And, you know, teams have peaks and valleys. That's why I pointed out St. John's. St. John's was a football powerhouse for years, and they're still good. St. John's won the conference this past year. They went 8-0 in the conference and 12-1 overall. St. Thomas finished third, going 6-2, 8-2 overall. But what you would have liked to see is the MEAC come out and justify their position, actually talk about why they came to the decision. But all they said, the only thing that they came out and said was that this was essentially for competitive parity. And they, I mean, it was 94 words. You're removing an original member of the conference, and you give that decision 94 words. And one of the great ironies here is that in the beginning of May, beginning of this month, there is a graduate from St. John's named Dennis McDonough, who has been named one of the five independent members of the NCAA Board of Governors, a prestigious position and certainly an accomplished man. He currently chairs the Rework America Task Force, and St. John's has been a long-standing rival of St. Thomas. You would think someone, certainly of even of his stature, somebody would have come out and said, we can't do this. Somebody would have said, this is ridiculous. They've set a high bar, not only in football over the past 11 years, but in all sports. And it is incumbent upon the conference not to remove them, but to get better. Let's get better instead of removing somebody. What happens if another school in the conference then goes on an 11 or 12-year run? Are you just going to remove them as well? Is that what you do? What happens in the Mountain West? If Fresno State suddenly, I mean, they've had a great year in sports. They won in baseball yesterday, holding on 4-3. They'll be playing UNLV tonight at 6:30. You'll hear that right here on 940 ESPN. Paul Leffler on the call. What happens if Fresno State, they've won four or five Mountain West titles this year, combo platter of regular season and conference championships in terms of like the football, winning the game up in Boise. What happens if Fresno State goes on a run over 10 or 11 years and just destroys everybody in the conference? Craig Thompson, Brett Gilliland and the boys out in Colorado Springs, they're going to get together and say, we really need to get rid of Fresno State. They're winning too much. Of course, they're not going to do that. This is just a sad decision by the MEAC. And hopefully it's not one that sets a precedent. Coming up is our Encore of the Week, Jill Guerin, voice of the Visalia Rawhide. This is the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
The Visalia Rawhide are a minor league team, single A, I believe. They are in the Arizona Diamondback system, and they have a cool situation there. They have a general manager who is named not John Reynolds, not Jack Reynolds, but Jennifer Reynolds. They have a woman general manager. I love that. I think that's fantastic. She's one of only five women who are a general manager of a minor league team, and their play-by-play person is also a woman. She is one of three out of about 160 or so across the country. She is also the director of broadcasting and media relations. She is sitting about 3.5 feet from me right now, and her name is Jill Guerin. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So I love your story, and I want people to hear it, because I think first of all, there should be more women in sports. I was in New York when Susan Waldman first cracked the mic with WFAN. I mean, I was there to hear her the first time she was on. And there should be more of her and Doris Burke and Holly Rowe and what have you. So you came from Hermosa Beach, beautiful community in Southern California, and you went to a great school in Boston. You went to Emerson. And from there, you started finding your way into the Red Sox.
Yeah, so I grew up a Red Sox fan. My dad likes to joke my first word was Pedro Martinez. Being able to work for the Red Sox is amazing. The reason why I got that opportunity was Tim Neverett, who was the play-by-play for WEEI, along with Joe Castiglione, is a graduate from Emerson College. So that internship is exclusive to Emerson students. I got it along with Matt Kuchar. Wow. He's now working for MLB Network. And I was able to have an amazing summer. I mean, what a great season to be a part of with the Red Sox last year. World Series champs. You can't get anything better than that.
That's right out of Hollywood.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to disparage another organization, but you could have been in college in Cincinnati and done a thing with the Reds, and you would have had a good time. But just happened, you're in Boston, you're where you want to be, you're with a team that you love, and they go on and just kick everybody's butt in the World Series. So you're working with WEEI, and you're doing stuff with the Red Sox, and you're doing all the jobs that we do when we start out in radio at a radio station or with a club. How did you find your way from Boston? And I know that you probably had the attitude, you tell me otherwise if I'm wrong, that wherever the big job for me, I don't care if it's in Guam, I'm going there.
Right, exactly. I mean, majoring in broadcast journalism, not just sports broadcasting, but broadcast journalism, you're taught you're going to go to a small market. If you want to be a TV reporter, you're going to start out in middle of nowhere, Iowa, something like that. So I had that
in my mind.
Which
is also a nice place, by the way.
Exactly, it is. It's not bad. It's not bad. But Hermosa to Boston to middle of nowhere, Iowa, culture change.
Yes.
So I was already mentally prepared for that, and I was able to get some play-by-play experience not only in college, but also, again, through Tim Neverett with the Nashua Silver Knights, who are part of the Futures League up in Nashua, New Hampshire. So I was able to create a reel from that. And then I was able to just start sending it out to places, and Visalia came up as one of the places that I knew had an opening for a broadcaster, and I actually knew someone who worked there. His name's Julian Rifkin. He also went to Emerson. He was a senior on the baseball team when I was a freshman on the softball team. So it was just connections. The GM's a woman. Again, one of those things where it just fell perfectly into place, and that's kind of what's been happening with my career path, and it's just very surreal that everything works out perfectly for me.
I think that's fantastic. And really, it's working out perfectly, but it's also a product of hard work. I'm a firm believer in, yeah, there is right place, right time, but the door opens. You have to have the chops to stay there, and you're certainly doing that, and you're off to a great start. Of course, we're talking with Jill Guerin, Director of Broadcasting and Media Relations for the Visalia Rawhide, single-A team down in Visalia, playing a neat little park, and we're gonna talk about that as well going forward. And you're right about small market, Jill, because what starting out in a small market does is, and we've all been there, it allows you to make mistakes. It allows you to make mistakes. It allows you to test and measure. It allows you to grow. You've had that experience already. How has it been your first night behind the mic for Visalia? What were you thinking?
It went so bad. It was just so bad. Just the nerves, figuring out what was going on. I don't even know. It was in my mind, I think I was just thinking, don't mess up. And that's the worst thing you can do,
right,
especially playing softball in college. That's the worst thing you can do in anything, just think, don't mess up. And after the first night being so terrible in my mind, I'm sure I was a little hard on myself. After that, I said, well, it can't get any worse,
that's
so
right.
Might as well have fun. And then I remember after the second day, I kind of took a breath and said, wow, that's really cool. I'm a professional broadcaster. This is something I've been talking about since I was 13. It was just really cool to think about that way.
Right. And I hats off to you for saying it didn't go well, because I don't know anybody, Jill, I don't know anybody who had a good first experience. I've joked on the air, the first time that I actually had a chance to host was filling in for Andrew Zimmern, who's the host of Travel Channel's Bizarre Foods. And he had a radio show in Minneapolis. Long story short, when I was sitting in for him, his opening theme came into my headphones, and I just sat there, wasn't saying anything. And finally, the producer said, you have to talk now.
Yeah.
And I was scared to death. So, yeah, but right, you, everything kicks in, all of your training kicks in, and you're not making it up as you go. You're just broadening and getting better, and you're evolving.
Right, and I think something that I've just really been good at is if I make a mistake, I kind of just laugh it off. The other day, instead of saying the 5-6 hole, I said 5-3 hole. And for those of you who don't know baseball, that's the entire infield, because third base is 5 and first base is 3. And I said 5-3 hole. So that's the entire infield. And I think I said, oh my gosh, I said 5-3. I'm so sorry. 5-6. Like, I've been good at just laughing it off, and you got to show some personality in it.
Absolutely. So let's talk about you in this organization. What is it like, you're on the roster is what, 20, 25 guys, and I emphasize guys. Had you gotten any, not pushback, but any, she's what? She's the play-by-play? Have you gotten any of that?
Not from our team. Our
Good.
Guys have been awesome. They're like brothers to me at this point. They're really fun. We have a great group of guys. If you guys ever have a chance to ever go to Rawhide Ballpark and see them play, they're just so much fun to watch.
Oh, we're all coming down.
Yeah.
Oh, I can tell you, we're all coming down. Yeah.
It's so much fun. And I haven't really had pushback from anyone. I think as far as the opposing teams, they've more so been surprised because there are times where I go into the opposing clubhouse after games because I have to give the box scores to the manager. So I'm walking in after the game, men are changing, showering, and they're just surprised. They're taken aback because I guess they're uncomfortable and they weren't given a heads up. Our guys have been given a heads up that that's what I'm going to be doing. So that's just kind of the standpoint. We're
the reason I ask is because there's a lot of men who have very caveman, archaic views of this field. And it's why I love that you're in it. During the College Football National Championship, Jill, I had a chance to talk to Holly Rowe from ESPN. And we had a good 4 or 5 minutes. And one of the things I asked her, she had these legendary, awkward, and uncomfortable interviews with Lloyd Carr walking off the field at halftime, and he would almost go out of his way to make her uncomfortable. And she, the pro that she is, she rose right above it, and she talked about how, you know, once we got to comfortable with each other, he realized that I was a pro and so on. And have you found as a woman, and there's so many more women in broadcasting now, have you found that you've encountered some that almost have this different bar of that you have to meet versus what men do?
I don't know if I've personally found that yet. I think I was very lucky working with the Red Sox. That was the first time I was in a clubhouse consistently, and the guys there are first class as well. And there's a lot of women who write about the Red Sox as well. So going into minor league baseball, I thought, this is going to be a piece of cake. If the majors are used to it, the minors have to be. And that's completely the opposite. It's actually less women in the minors than there are in the majors.
Right.
So I think that was a little bit of a culture shock for me. I haven't exactly felt like I had to prove myself, but I think I can tell when a light bulb switch is on for someone saying, oh, she played the game. Oh, she gets it. I can see a light bulb turn on sometimes.
And I want to talk about that because you were a softball player.
Yep.
You played for Emerson. You were captain your senior year, were
yep.
you not?
Yep.
That is also a position you play.
First base.
Right.
Did
on.
Not like running. Played first.
You didn't like running. How'd your team do your senior year?
We made it to the playoffs, and that was the first time we made it to the NUMAC conference playoff tournament ever, because we moved up conferences. I think it was the year before I attended there, and the conference there is insane. WPI, MIT, Wheaton, Wellesley, just such a great conference, and we had to really take another step and just put some dedication into it, and we were able to make it our senior year. And this past year, now that I've been gone, they actually won a playoff game, so they're moving up.
And I know I saw a picture of you as a player, which
yep.
is very cool. We're talking with Jill Guerin. She is the Director of Broadcasting and Media Relations for the Visalia Rawhide. She's also their play-by-play voice. Let's talk about the team itself. California League,
yep.
Lots of rivals out here, and then there's other teams. What are the other minor league teams? I know one of them I'm very familiar with, Kane County,
mm-hmm.
In Geneva, out in Illinois. But what are the other teams in the system, in the Arizona system?
So, Hillsboro, Missoula, and then Reno's the AAA, and the AA is Jackson Generals.
Is it the Aces?
Yep.
Is it, okay. And does the travel, you're doing the road games as well?
I'm not doing the road games.
Okay,
yep.
so that's an immediate bonus in the sense that you're not grinding it out on all the trips.
There's definitely pros and cons. The pros are I get some time to go home occasionally, kind of catch up on stuff. The cons, I'm not able to catch up with the team as much. I'm not able to. I have to read the box scores or listen to the game to figure out what's going on. I'm also technically, I guess for lack of a better word, the liaison between our team and the other team. So the broadcaster, I have to be almost on call if there's ever a roster change. So I mean, I've been getting texts from our manager, Sean Roof, at 11:15 when I was ready to go to bed saying, I need a scoring change happening and just things like that. So definitely pros and cons. I'm happy for my first full season that I'm okay with not traveling, but I'm hoping to make it happen.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to look at it because I've talked to other broadcasters like yourself in the minor leagues, and some have traveled, some have not, and they've said almost the same thing that you have. When you got behind the mic, what was the thing that surprised you most as you started to get into the flow and get comfortable down in Visalia?
I think how I'm not able to talk as fast as some of the other broadcasters when they do play-by-play, because whenever it's a bang-bang play or kind of a weird play, I can see myself just sit and take it in and think about what I'm supposed to say, and I need to work on just go for it and just start rambling. Even if you mess it up, you can go back and explain it. It's better than just being silent and say, wow, that was crazy, and then having to backtrack. I think that's been something that, because I've always been able to talk fast. That's my mom always says, I don't shut up. So
yeah, that's right. That's right. So you're down there. You're doing this. What you've had this great career path, and I felt like I saw a quote attached to you somewhere, Jill, saying it felt a little different, or was unique, or was unusual being referred to as a trailblazer.
Yeah.
But there is an element of that attached to you because you are. I mean, when you're one of three, and I'm not sure if there are more right now.
Yeah, I believe it's now eight total.
Still.
I think if we're talking about voice of the teams, quote unquote, it's six. So there's two other ones who are the second voice, if that makes sense.
It does. So that's, we're talking less than, what, 5% here?
Yeah.
Of minor leagues. That is so impressive. How do you feel about that? Because, listen, I've got daughters who are listening to you right now, and they're digging this. I can guarantee you they're loving this. You are a role model.
Yeah,
you are someone for young ladies to look up to.
It's very uncomfortable for me to think of myself as that. I think it brings more pressure because I'm thinking if I mess up, some of the people who are small-minded might say, then women can't be broadcasters because if I mess up. So that's a little bit of pressure that way. But it's also cool because I'm kind of writing my own rules.
Mm-hmm.
So when I first talked to Sean Roof over the phone before they were even in Visalia, and I said to him, what's the protocol with women going into the clubhouse? And we kind of both realized there wasn't one. So I kind of just made my own rules, and I'm going to kind of go with it because whatever rules I make is probably going to be what's followed in the California League now for women as broadcasters.
No question. And I there's probably a certain level of pressure on you and the other women, whether they are the lead voice or they are the second, in that, you know, just like when Jessica Mendoza went into the booth, and I think she does a tremendous job.
Right.
She knows the game. Obviously, the New York Mets thought so,
mm-hmm.
Bringing her into their organization as well. But there is that added level of pressure on having to step it up because you want to do well for women who are going to come after you. Do you ever feel that, or is it something that you feel when you're not necessarily in the booth?
Yeah, it's not something that I'm thinking about during the booth. When I'm broadcasting the games, it's more so afterwards, and I guess the way I handle myself during batting practice almost even, just the way I interact with the guys in the back of my mind, I know it's platonic. But I'm always wondering, is someone judging the way
sure.
that I'm acting and something like that? Because these players are my age. I'm 22. They're in their early 20s. It's that sort of thing. And they've been so respectful. They've been awesome. But I always have in my back of my mind, are people thinking different things? Are they thinking that women are just being here because they want to find a boyfriend? Because I've had people and I told them, oh, that's what I'm doing. And someone will say, oh, well, you can find a boyfriend. I'm thinking, no, that's – and they don't mean it in a – malicious way. They're just thinking, oh, well, you can find a boyfriend. I'm like, yeah, if they have a cousin, sure, but not the actual players.
So you have this cool list of things, your favorite this, your least favorite that, your favorite movie?
Bull Durham,
okay. All right, and your favorite meal is pasta. You didn't even have to respond to this one when I saw most hated sports team.
The Yankees.
Of course they are. Of course they are. And I, you know what? I am right there with you on pet peeves. People who are?
Rude. It's
yes.
just so annoying. I mean, I don't know if I go out of my way to be nice exactly, but I feel like being rude, you're going out of your way to be rude.
I'm with you. And we share one other on here. We share a few things on here, but we share one other on here. Your desired superpower? To fly,
that's yeah. right.
How great would that be?
I've there's something about when I'm a little kid on a swing. I used to love just
yes.
going on swing sets. That was my favorite part.
And yep. as a play-by-play voice, you can say, you know what, I'm going to fly. There's going to be a play at second here. I'm going to fly over second. I'm going to get a downward view on this.
Exactly. I would love to be able to get some closer views on the plays, definitely.
Last thing for you, and I could talk to you forever, and you're welcome back here anytime.
Thank you.
And that is, what... You're happy where you're at, but, you know, there's everybody gets on the stairway. What would be the ideal Jill Guerin end game?
I mean, play-by-play announcer for the Boston Red Sox.
Oh, there you go.
That's
okay.
I said that on my eighth grade graduation. I gave a speech my eighth grade graduation. I told everyone I was going to be the play-by-play announcer for the Boston Red Sox, and they laughed. I ended up being in the Red Sox radio booth, which is awesome, but that's definitely the end goal. But I mean, obviously I'll take anything that I can as far as baseball. I just want to be involved in baseball. It's my first love.
Well, I listen, my hat is off to you. I love your career path, Jill, and you're going to do just great. I mean, the fact that you have gotten this position as well as being the director of broadcasting media relations, I think it's wonderful. Like I said, we're gonna all come down. I'll make a point of dropping you a note when we're coming down there because we, you know, got to get a picture of us
Perfect.
With you in the booth.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Folks, she is Jill Guerin, very talented young lady, director of broadcasting media relations for the Visalia Rawhide. Six teams, eight teams in California?
Eight teams.
Okay. And she's also their play-by-play announcer. Check her out. And when you see her at the stadium, just say hi to her. Good to meet you.
Good to meet you, too. Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Coming up at 8:05, we'll talk with Bob Busser, ballpark, stadium, arena, photographer, historian, one of the best in the business at that. We were supposed to have him on yesterday. Giants game ran long, extra innings. They lose, of course, 5-4 to the Braves. Bob joins me this morning. I appreciate him rescheduling as well. Email from Chuck. What I find to be most abhorrent about the MEAC's decision is the colleges in this conference do not follow a philosophy of excellence in all the schools' endeavors. Athletics does not warrant the same pursuit of excellence. Academics does. The $64 question is, why not? He also adds, will this decision have any kind of adverse impact on the remaining colleges in the MEAC? I'll just say this. Thank you for the email. You can always email me, cgp@940espnfresno.com. And I put this out on Twitter as well. And Chuck, I think you and I are of the same mind of this based upon what you wrote me. I think that this really gives us a very crystal clear look at the presidents of these other universities in the MEAC. And I said as much in the first half hour, and I'll say it again. Their silence is inexcusable. And to your point that you made, Chuck, I think it will be a lasting embarrassment to them and the conference. They can equate this and justify this any way they like. But when you dig a little bit here, you know, when you dig a little deeper here, Star Tribune is the paper of record in Minneapolis. And really, there's the other paper there at this university. St. Thomas is in St. Paul. Paper in St. Paul, outstanding paper, the Pioneer Press. But the Star Tribune, Randy Johnson wrote a great piece, and he points out something that I mentioned a little bit earlier. And it bears mentioning again that the meetings to oust St. Thomas, all of these meetings, and I equated this on Twitter to the Hal Holbrook movie, The Star Chamber. Remember The Star Chamber? When a decision in a court case didn't go the way all these former judges thought it should, they would meet in an undisclosed location. Nobody knew who they were, and they would essentially mete out their own justice. They would take justice into their own hands. This is obviously not about a life and death situation. We're talking about sports, but these meetings were done in secret. And the only reason they came to this decision is because they realized that they needed to have, to do something like this, they needed to have enough votes if they were going to have a conference vote to vote them out. And they felt that they believed that they had 9 votes of the 13 schools. There were 4 schools that were going to vote against it. St. Thomas, I mentioned St. John's, also St. Benedict, and maybe Bethel. But, again, Julie Sullivan saying St. Thomas expended tremendous effort to remain in the MEAC and stabilize the conference. However, the presidents came to a consensus that the conference itself would cease to exist in its current form if St. Thomas remained. And again, I mention this a little bit more just because it is not or should not be the burden of St. Thomas or of any school in any conference. It should not be their burden that if they are better than the other schools athletically, that's not their fault. And, I'm reminded of the place that I came from before I got here, when I was in Fargo, North Dakota. You can't deny the remarkable success of North Dakota State football. They play in the Missouri Valley Football Conference, and they have owned that conference for the last 8 years. And before, when they were a Division II team, they owned Division II as well. But the Missouri Valley Football Conference, the other schools like Illinois State, Youngstown State, Indiana State, and others throughout the Midwest, instead of the conference saying, you've won 7 national titles, in 8 years. We can't compete with you. Nobody has crowds like you do up in the Fargo Dome. We're going to get rid of you. Instead of doing that, what the conference did was, well, nothing. The other schools got better. Illinois State nearly won a national championship. They had to beat North Dakota State to do it, and they didn't. They lost in the final 39 seconds of the game down in Frisco, Texas. But what North Dakota State did was they raised the bar of the conference in terms of the radar they were on. It used to be the East Coast conferences. East and the Southeast, Eastern Seaboard, were the dominant conferences. A couple of them out there were the dominant conferences in FCS. North Dakota State changed that. But instead of going weasel like the MEAC did, the other schools said, we're going to get better. We're going to hire better coaches. We're going to recruit better athletes. You know, academics are still a prime focus, but we're going to get better. And they have. The conferences, they are the preeminent conference in FCS for football, hands down. And when a school is just better than everybody, when Boise State was dominating, was there any thought of getting them out? Well, I'm sure there's a lot of fans, Fresno State fans, that could do without Boise State. But I mean, in all seriousness, they've raised the bar. You know, their national footprint, like them or not, they raised the bar. And they forced everybody else to get better. You've heard Cam Worrell on this program say as much. So when a conference member in a particular sport or in a number of sports, and going back to the very beginning, talking about UCLA and USC back in the old Pac-8, when they're better than everybody else, your job isn't to whine. It's not to hold a secret meeting in a basement somewhere and then kick the school out. It becomes incumbent upon you to get better. As Herm Edwards said, and as Seawalk posted on Twitter, on my Twitter, at CG Program, you play to win the game. All right, coming up, we're going to talk stadiums and stadium food with my good friend Bob Busser. He's also an award winner this year. We'll talk about that as well. Glad you're hanging out with us. This is the CGP.
The studios of 940 ESPN in Fresno, California. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Hour number two, CGP for a Friday, begins right now, 3 minutes, 39 seconds past the hour of 8 a.m. Pacific Daylight Saving Time. Glad to have you aboard. Gorgeous day here in the Central Valley. Hope it is equally so wherever you happen to be. It's been nice this month. Has not been like May from last year when it was just the 90s started to creep in and I just started to just get edgy and it just gets ugly when it gets too hot. You know, we were supposed to have Mr. Bob Busser join this program yesterday. I've said it before and I'm not overstating it. He is one of the preeminent ballpark and arena photographers in this country. He's also an historian. He knows his stuff. He has photographed over 900 venues. Over 75,000 images you can find on his website. I look at every single one of those images every single day. Bob Busser joins me right now. How are you, my friend?
Good morning, CG. How are you?
Doing very well. Thank you for being kind enough to reschedule. The Giants went a little long yesterday, and it's good to have you this morning. Let's just start right off the bat with this. You, first of all, congratulations. You are the winner of the 2019 Tony Salen Memorial Award that is given out from the Baseball Reliquary. Very well deserved. Tell folks what it is.
It's an award that's given to individuals like myself and some writers and people who have different takes on baseball and like lifelong, like myself, a ballpark historian. There's musicians who've written songs about baseball that have gotten it, and some writers, Peter Goldenbach, I believe, got it. There's also ball players, the Shrine of the Eternals. This year, J.R. Richard is going in, the former Astros pitcher, Billy Beane, the A's president, and Lisa Fernandez, the UCLA Hall of Fame pitcher, she's also going in. So it's kind of like a mini Hall of Fame in a way.
That's very cool. You're going in with good company. I certainly remember J.R. Richard. That was he was a giant out there on the mound. And if I remember right, he had a heart condition, did he not?
He had a stroke.
A stroke. That's
actually,
right. Yeah.
And he was never the same. And it's a sad story. I believe he was homeless for a time, but
yeah.
He's bounced back. And he scared the hell out of people on the mound. I mean, he was huge. I mean, I think he's, 6'7",
big
six,
man.
Eight, something like that.
Yes.
He's a big man. And all arms and that ball I remember watching him, the ball just exploded out of his hand. I'm like, this guy is just unhittable.
Well, and you're going in, you're going in with great company. Besides J.R. Richard, Lisa Fernandez, she was a tremendous player at UCLA, and certainly Billy Beane, one of the better, one of the brightest minds in baseball. You know, I was looking at the article that announced your winning this Memorial Award, the Tony Salen Memorial Award. And you said something that I could really relate to when you said you were a transistor radio kid of the 60s. You know, Bob, before we start talking about some other stuff having to do with your photos and what have you, I think with all the electronic advances that we have now with iPhones and Androids and what have you, those days were fun because I'm with you. I would go to sleep listening to the White Sox or the Cubs on the West Coast with the little, the little earphone and the little transistor, and, hiding it under my pillow at night so my parents wouldn't hear me listening to a game on a Wednesday night. Those were fun days.
Oh, we grew, CG, you and I are the same age, and we grew up in a great era. As a matter of fact, that's how I got my start in this when I was a little kid. I listened to Vin Scully talk about Crosley Field and Fenway Park and Connie Mack Stadium, Ford Field, and he can paint a picture like no other. And as a little kid, I was like, I got to see these places. And then growing up in Southern California in Fullerton, my buddy Howard Haberman and I, we would go to Angel games when we were in high school, and we'd spend the $1, $1.50, sit in the upper deck and sneak our way down, and watch Nolan Ryan pitch with 5,000 people in the stands when the Angels were absolutely awful. They had Nolan Ryan and nobody else. And those memories, you have for a lifetime, and I wouldn't change a thing. I love the era I grew up in, especially with rock and roll music, the Beatles, the British Invasion, on up to today, and sports. Sports has changed so much in the last, 40, 50 years. And we have seen a lot of milestones. For me, the Red Sox winning the World Series in 2004, it can't be topped. I thought I'd never see the Red Sox win the World Series, and boom, here they did.
Well, it's funny you should say that. Folks, we're talking with my good friend Bob Busser. He's really, I'm not overstating this, one of the preeminent ballpark and arena historians, a wonderful photographer. It's interesting that the Red Sox, they got all the mention and with all the romanticism about winning in 2004. It had been so many years, over 80 years. And then the following year, the Chicago White Sox, my team, won, and it had been just as long. Nobody cares about the White Sox. So that's just, unfortunately. But I'm with you with everything you said. I think that's very well stated. As you look at stadiums, you've been all over the country, all over North America. We talk about throwback stadiums, and we talk about Camden Yards and PNC Park in Pittsburgh. How throwback are they? I mean, because they've got the dark green seats, and they incorporate, Bob, as you well know, a lot of these parks incorporate various pieces of a park, whether it's the overhang at the Texas ballpark or a larger wall somewhere. But how throwback really are these parks?
They're modernized throwbacks, if that makes any sense. They have the throwback feel, but they all have the luxury boxes. They all have, Yankee Stadium, the new Yankee Stadium. They have all these five-star restaurants and all that stuff that, honestly, the true fan does not care about. I'm sorry, but most fans like you and I, we want a hot dog and a beer and want to watch the game.
Yep.
We want to see the game. We don't want to be seen. But that's what it is. It's trying to bring the romance of – Ebbets Field and the Polo Grounds back into the modern era, because most of us never saw Ebbets Field or the Polo Grounds or some of those older ballparks. And to be honest with you, most of those old ballparks, Crosley Field, Forbes Field in Pittsburgh, they have a romanticism to them. You know, it's a bygone era. That's what they're trying to do. PNC Park, is a great retro park, I guess you could call it, because you have the view of downtown Pittsburgh and the Roberto Clemente Bridge right there, and it's spectacular, just like the former AT&T Park here in San Francisco.
You put a picture up today, a series of pictures from a place in Shreveport, Louisiana. And folks, if you haven't seen Bob's work, you really should go see it. I'm going to put the website up a couple of times today. It's ballparks.smugmug. I love that name. .com. But you put a picture up today of a place that you said was one of your favorites down in Shreveport called Spar Stadium. And when you see a place like this, I want you to talk about Spar Stadium. When you see a stadium that has just fallen in disrepair, you know, it looks like an office building in Detroit, where just a place that used to be loved and visited, and there was an energy, and now it's just gone. What does that do to you as a ballpark historian?
It's sad in a way, and I'll get to a point on Tiger Stadium in a second. But the first time I saw Spar Stadium in Shreveport was the late 80s. They had been gone for about 3 years to the new park, which is now abandoned in the fairgrounds in Shreveport. But if you walk into it, it's kind of like the Patton movie where, you know, you hear the music playing and he sees the battlefield in front of him, George C. Scott. And I can picture Hank Aaron played there, mm-hmm. Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, they all played here. And another thought to that was I took my wife, Noreen, to Yankee Stadium in 02 for the first time, and that's the first thing she said. We walked in there, and she goes, my God, Babe Ruth played here. Lou Gehrig was here, you know, and that's what runs through my mind. And then you see the decay, and you just think it's sad. You know, they just let it rot. Most of the structure is gone now, but all the times I visited up until 2016 when the last time I was in Shreveport, it was almost like the ghost town Bodie, a state of arrested decay, where they just let it fall apart. And as you know, the Southeast, the humidity in July and August is just, it's so oppressive, and it just eats it away. I mean, the seats were, you know, wood seats that were just rotted away, but it tells a story, much like the ballpark in Amarillo where Tony Gwynn played in the early 80s, Potter County Stadium, same thing. They have a new ballpark in Amarillo, and they're just kind of letting this go to waste.
We're talking with Bob Busser, stadium, ballpark, arena historian, photographer. His work is outstanding. I strongly encourage you to visit it. And I always love that I say this every time you come on the program, and I always get emails from listeners saying, oh, my goodness, I went to Bob's site. That stuff is great there. Ballparks.smugmug.com, S-M-U-G-M-U-G.com. You mentioned to me in an email another ballpark, and I had a friend that I went to college with from Spartanburg, South Carolina, and so you mentioned Duncan Park, and I had no idea, I never would have known this if it wasn't for you, that they had seats from Connie Mack Stadium in there.
Yes, they did. I think they've refurbished the seats, and they're still there. I haven't been back there in years, and I need to get back to Spartanburg. But, they had Connie Mack Stadium seats, the old wooden seats. They were green and they were red and they were pretty much falling apart, but they were there. And I sat myself down in one, and you know, as a ballpark freak, you think, oh my God, these were actually in Philadelphia, in North Philadelphia, and Connie Mack Stadium. And, Spartanburg is just an old minor league park that, it's used much now for local colleges and high school teams, as opposed, there's no minor league team that plays there anymore. And by the way, the clubhouse, your master closet in your home is bigger than the clubhouse. The GQ was, and it was low. I mean, anybody over 6 foot had to duck to get in. It's tight and tiny.
We're talking with Bob Busser, stadium and ballpark and arena historian and photographer. When you go around North America, is there last time we talked with you, you talked about how you shoot a park. Is there something you're drawn to more than others? For example, you mentioned some of the parks, PNC Park, some of your old favorites, a place like Fenway Park, or going down to Anaheim, all the changes that have happened. at the ballpark where the Angels play. It's gone through different names, obviously, over the years. Are you more excited to go see one of those parks or maybe a high school gym, like your old gym, Fullerton Union High School gym, which, as you've told me, is now condemned? What do you find, what do you get more jazzed up to see?
Honestly, the smaller venues like that, and some I'm a big Ivy League and Patriot League fan. I've been to all the campuses, and seeing their venues, that are, most of them, say for Dartmouth College, the football stadium is almost 100 years old. And you go to Harvard Stadium, and you walk in there, and the first thing I thought of with my musical background is Janis Joplin's last place she played when she was still alive was Harvard Stadium. And you walk in there, and you think, my God, the Kennedys went here. And just the history that even their hockey venues, like, for example, Cornell and Colgate University, they have hockey venues now. That Colgate's got a brand-new, beautiful hockey building. And I was talking to some of the SIDs at the colleges, and they were telling me, and I did not know this, that before their buildings, even at Yale, they played on frozen ponds. They played on little lakes. They didn't have a building. And if they had a mild winter, they were pretty much screwed. They had to go Yale had to play in New York or Philadelphia or something. And, you know, Colgate had to go to Buffalo and other places to find ice to play.
That is crazy. And you mentioned Dartmouth. Dartmouth is actually at the top of your page right now. Their football stadium. You know what else I want to talk with you about? I want to talk with you about stadium food. And you know, you and I are big foodies, and we love to talk about places like Tommy's or Chicago Dogs, Deep Dish Pizza in Chicago, Grinders in Boston, Cheesesteaks in Philly. This is one of the things, again, for those of us of an age, we don't need to mention ages, but those of us who are a little older, yeah, I remember going to Comiskey Park and as a kid, because my dad was a Southsider, and the food stands, Bob, probably similar to the way you grew up down in Southern California, the food stands were run by families. And the families, the Ciratori family would have the Italian sausages and the Brajoles, and the Petropoulos family, they would have Greek food and so on. And the smells of Comiskey, you could smell it down the street. It was wonderful. But now you have these companies, I'm not going to mention them by name, but these companies that have taken over food service, and I really feel like much the same as the old ballparks, Bob, I think we've missed something with the food as well.
My first time to Fenway Park was July of 76, as I've told you before, and my mom and dad and cousins went to see the Queen of England in a parade. Okay, great. I went to Fenway Park to see my Red Sox. I got the better of the deal, but I will never forget this. There was this little Italian guy outside Fenway Park in his deep, thick Boston accent screaming pistachios, peanuts, ricotta, you know, the whole bit. I go back 20 or 30 years later, that guy is still there. You could smell the sausages, like you said. You know, they grill them outside Lancaster, right in back of the Green Monster. They had sausage carts. They had hot dog carts. They had the Euros. They had the pistachio guy who, from what they told me, has since retired. But if you went into Tiger Stadium, like you said, Comiskey Park, you could smell the Italian sausage sandwiches from Hamtramck. It's a smell that you cannot replicate anywhere. I don't care. L.A., we had the Dodger Dogs. And, you know, as you and I have talked, my buddy Howard and I, we would go to Dodger games on a little roadie for us from Fullerton, stop at Tommy's, slam down a double chili cheese, and then go have Dodger dogs and watch the Dodgers. But that is the thing I remember. Like you said, the food has changed for the good and for the bad. Fenway Park is a perfect example. Again, in 76, the food was awful. They had Fenway Franks that were terrible. But now, for the good and bad, they've really they've incorporated legal seafood is in there now, and they have a lot of different choices. The food outside of like the main servers of food that we won't mention, a lot of the ballparks now have. I know Dodger Stadium has Carl's Jr. and some of these other places, which is fine. But San Diego is a perfect example. Petco, they have so many microbrews. They've got the fish tacos. They have all the local flavor that you want. And that's what I've noticed a lot in the ballparks. They try to get the local flavor of the area.
Yeah, there's no question. And you snuck in Legal Seafood. For those who aren't familiar with Legal Seafood, they have been providing clam chowder at presidential inaugurations for probably more than a half a century. I'm not sure how far it goes back. But also, you mentioned the Queen of England. Listen, let's not try to kid anybody. You've always been an English royalty guy, Bob.
Yeah, I know. She forgave me and she knighted me, so it's good.
Well, you're a big guy, so she probably had to reach up real high to get to the shoulders. When you look at ballparks today, what is a feature of these new, the throwback parks as you were mentioning, but they're modernized? What's a feature that you think is lacking in these parks that a lot of the architects are missing?
That's a good question. Not lacking is the fact that they finally have room on the concourses now. Growing at Comiskey as a kid, it was tight. I mean, and they had those never-ending ramps and the corridors and the ramps that led to nowhere at Old Comiskey Park. But, as a kid, you knew every inch of Comiskey Park. I knew every inch of Anaheim Stadium. That's where we grew up. But lacking, a lot of the park is too much commercialism and too much, it's too much the corporate garbage. It's not the I'm going to go back to Yankee Stadium again. The Yankees are not treating their true fans very well. They stick them in the upper deck, triple the price of the seats. The bleacher seats are now, $70 a pop? That's ridiculous. For bleacher seats, if the Red Sox are in town or something like that, that's crazy. And that's another thing that I do not like is the premier games where they jack the prices up three times to go see a game. For the Yankees that come into San Francisco or the Red Sox or the Dodgers or the Cubs. I think that's wrong. You're gouging the fans. You're gouging the people that are supporting your team.
Yeah, and one of the things that you've pointed out to me, and it's a great observation, and it's something that because you travel all over the place to see these, you can notice this instantly. The old parks that you love, that I love, that you photographed, Tiger Stadium, Fenway, Wrigley, Old Comiskey, what made those parks special is that because those were built in the days that they didn't have luxury suites, but the luxury suites have become a necessary function of new stadiums, and Bob, they push those fans in the upper decks. They push them back and up so much further back and so much higher up than the old days. For me, that's one thing that I miss, and that's the better sight lines.
Absolutely. I completely agree. Like I said, I was at Yankee Stadium for the new Yankee Stadium for the first time last September, and I was not impressed. I mean, it's massive. The upper deck seats, you're way up there. It's not like we've talked about before, Chicago Stadium or Mile High Stadium in Denver, where the seats were so angled and the noise went straight down. They're massive, and back in the day, Tiger Stadium, Fenway Park, Wrigley Field, those were built on city blocks. They didn't have acreage like they did, like when the Dodgers and the Giants moved west. And, the Giants had Candlestick Park and, 8 miles of parking around it. There was no parking in Ebbets Field. Fenway Park, good luck trying to find a place to park. Same thing with Tiger Stadium. And as you know, Wrigley Field and Comiskey was a little different, but Wrigley Field parking is not good. Most people take the L in they take the buses in that the Cubs provide.
Give me three venues, whether they're baseball, basketball, high school, whatever, give me three venues that if somebody came to you today and said, Bob, you can go to, for the next couple of weeks, three different venues just to kind of hang out in and go to games if they're in season, what would the three venues be?
Now, could these be former, no longer standing?
Yes, absolutely.
First, right off the bat is Connie Mack Stadium. I don't know what it is, but North Philadelphia. It's not a great neighborhood,
no.
But that ballpark has always fascinated me. You had the big rotunda in front that held, Connie Mack's office, before it was Scheib Park. And right up the street was Baker Bowl, which when it opened in the 1800s was a show place, and it ended up in the 30s as a garbage pile. It was falling apart, and the Phillies could not wait to abandon. Second would probably be the Olympia in Detroit. I got in there when they were tearing it down. A buddy of mine took me in with flashlights, and we're walking around this dilapidated arena that looked like a bomb went off. And in my mind, again, I'm thinking, my God, Gordie Howe skated on this ice. you know, Sid Howe, Jack Adams, they were all here. Rocket Richard played here for the Canadians. You know, that's what goes through my mind. It's like I can picture it in my mind when I'm walking through these places. And third would have to be Ebbets Field. I mean, built on a garbage dump in Pigtown, Ebbets Field was, the football follies of ballparks. You name it, everything went wrong. When they opened Ebbets Field, they didn't have a press box. They forgot to put the press box in. No one had a key the opening day to unlock the gates to get the people in. It was just, it was a comedy of errors at Ebbets Field, but it has that charm in that history that fascinates everybody. You know, I think if you ask a lot of people, that's the first park they want to go to is Ebbets Field.
Yeah, there's no question. And my father went there when he was young, and he had some very fond memories of visiting there. Couple more things for you. Stadium food, since we talked about it, what's your favorite stadium food? What's the best sandwich or item that you've had at a stadium or a ballpark or an arena?
They would probably have to be the Italian sausages at Tiger Stadium from Hamtramck. Oh, they did it just right. I can taste it now. Okay, you're getting me hungry, CG. And by the way, Tommy serves a breakfast burrito, I just found out, with chili. So we got to throw that on our schedule, dude.
They need to sponsor my program. It's really that simple.
I'm telling you, man, I'd be on every week then. But the sausage sandwich in Hamtramck, they did the peppers just right. You know, they have to be grilled just right. So they had that little bit of char on them, but they're still tasty.
You got to have firmness. They have to have a little firmness. So they got to have a bite. They can't be mushy.
Absolutely. And the sausage had that little bit of snap to it. And you put a little bit of mustard on it, and it was really good.
Yeah.
It was at the top.
Now sources tell me that your lovely wife is actually working at home today, and I just hope that you are waiting on her. You're cooking for her. You're doing everything that you need to be doing for her.
Yes, our kids, Fenway and Crosley, are upstairs with her. She's listening right now. She's upstairs. She is working from home. It's going to be a holiday weekend, and it's a barbecue weekend at the Butcher household. So, we're going to throw some sausages and shish kebabs on the grill this weekend.
I'll be looking for my email invite for that. Absolutely. Listen,
welcome anytime. You know that.
Listen, congratulations again on being the recipient of the 2019 Tony Salen Memorial Award. It's a great honor for you, and it's really well deserved. Your work is outstanding. Bob's going to be receiving that. It's going to be the Shrine of the Eternals Induction Day on Sunday, July 14th, and that's going to be at the Donald Wright Auditorium in the Pasadena Central Library. A great thrill. I'm going to try my hardest to be there. It would be such a great pleasure to photograph you getting this award. And, folks, if you want to check out Bob's great work, you can go to ballparks.smugmug.com. I will put that on Twitter. I'm at CG Program. Very easy to find me. You can also follow Bob. He's at Bob Busser, B-U-S-S-E-R. Bob, always a great pleasure. Have a wonderful holiday weekend, and we'll be talking to you probably next month.
Thank you, buddy. I will talk to you soon. Thanks again, CG, for all your support, and I love being on your show. I've been on – we can't count that high, but it's been a pleasure. We go back to Fargo, so it's all good.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chris.
All right, there you go. Coming up, we're going to move from stadiums and arenas and ballparks to films with our good man, Nick Shager from Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire. This is the CGP.
There may be no busier film critic, no greater elite movie mind than Nick Shager. He can talk Hollywood, Cannes, Sundance, Fargo, Budapest, Kathmandu. If there's a film to be seen or a film festival to attend, he is on it. Here's Nick Shager.
Well, from stadium, ballpark, and arena photography, award-winning Bob Busser, we go to highly acclaimed Nick Shager, Daily Beast, Variety, Esquire, Yahoo Movies. Nick, good afternoon. Actually, good morning. It's almost afternoon for you.
Almost. Happy Memorial Day weekend, let's say. It's nice to know we finally have hit a holiday.
No question about it. Before we talk about some really interesting films coming out this weekend, I've always wanted to ask you this, and I can't believe in all the years you've been coming on with me, I've never asked this. You know, I grew up in Chicago, and then I moved back as an adult, and I had the pleasure of watching Siskel and Ebert and meeting them once as well. And they were terrific, and they were terrific because they were so different in their approaches, but they were so good and thorough at what they do. And you remind me of both of them. You remind me more, probably more of, I would say Gene Siskel, but just because Gene was much more of a sports fan than Roger was. But have you ever had the desire to maybe, you know, you and maybe a colleague have a show like that?
Well, you know, I think every film critic sort of has those ideas at some point, because so many of us did grow up watching Siskel and Ebert and wanting to emulate them in some way or another. But you know, unfortunately for everybody else, I'd say, the TV landscape, I think, has just changed. And I think that whereas that was a real way to give people a weekly insight into film criticism outside of the confines, let's say, of the newspaper, now we have so many venues, especially with the internet, that there doesn't seem to be the same sort of opportunity for television. I mean, I would love it. I love, you know, just like coming on here, I love talking about the stuff as much as I like writing about it. And, you know, there are lots of other sort of, you know, smaller media venues for that. But as you can see from the fact that nobody ever replaced them, even though they did try and reboot that show, both after Gene Siskel passed away, and then even when Roger Ebert stepped aside, you know, there was some sort of magic between the two of them that was not easily replicatable. And so, if anybody out there wants to give me an opportunity, sure, give me a call.
Did you ever hear the story? I bet you have, of why it was called Siskel and Ebert.
You mean that I do remember that there was something about the two of them arguing about whose name went.
Well,
it's
one of these crazy, silly little stories. It was supposed to be Ebert and Siskel. And when they put the letters up on the marquee for the opening shot, the guys putting it up put up the wrong name first. They put up Siskel and Ebert. That's how the first show ran, and that's why they kept it that way.
Yeah, I seem to remember Ebert, halfway complaining about that, or making, you know, sort of jokes that weren't totally jokes about that. But, you know, their rivalry, you know, it was sort of that love-hate thing that really fueled that dynamic.
There's no doubt, and the fact that they were on rival papers. Roger Ebert was the Sun-Times, and Gene Siskel was on the Chicago Tribune. They were huge rivals. They argued vehemently, but they loved each other. They were great friends as well. Nick, a couple of fascinating films coming out this weekend. The obvious one is Aladdin. I'm not a big fan of taking something that was a wonderful, just a creative. I loved Aladdin with Robin Williams and the voice. I thought it was great. Is this going to come close to that?
Well, it's certainly going to be the big Memorial Day weekend movie for sure. And you know, Aladdin has been, is arriving on the wave of, I would say, very sort of mixed to negative buzz. The early looks at the film in images, in trailers, especially of Will Smith as the genie, both when he was seen blue and not blue, were, let's say, less than positive. And so I have to admit, I was somewhat surprised by the fact that this movie is not anything close to a disaster. It actually is perfectly serviceable. Now, I know that doesn't sound like great praise, and I guess it's not, but the truth is this one seemed like it was headed toward real trouble, and instead it winds up being the kind of film that if you're looking for a live-action version of a movie you already liked in animated form, you're not going to be severely disappointed. For the most part, the movie, directed by Guy Ritchie, who's mostly known for British crime films, is a very faithful adaptation. All the songs that everybody loved are there, the big numbers are there, and the plot is basically the same. There are a few additions. Some of them are weird. There's a weird subplot where the genie actually has a romantic love interest who's a human, which I can't even begin to sort of get into because it makes so little sense. There are a couple of musical numbers that are new that sort of give especially Princess Jasmine more of a feminist bent. But for the most part, the problem with the movie is it just doesn't feel very urgent. It feels like, you know, a sort of second-rate version of a better animated film, and that's definitely true of Will Smith as well. Robin Williams, to my mind, the genie was maybe Robin Williams' best character and performance. It was just so purely
Robin Williams, and Will Smith does try and make the genie his. I actually found that when he stuck more to the original version of the genie, it worked better, and he was funnier. The more he tried to make it more of a sort of Will Smith hip-hop version of the genie, it felt strained and sort of corny and didn't really fit the material. But again, these are sort of minor. I think people who are excited about the movie are going to come away not being disappointed. If you have a feeling like with many of these other Disney live action remakes that they aren't necessary, you're going to feel like this one isn't as well.
Yeah. You mentioned something about Guy Ritchie. I mean, this is the guy who, if I'm not mistaken, the two of the films that come to mind, at least for me, at least one of the Sherlock Holmes movies and King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. And it seems like you and I have talked about this before. We're going to Aladdin, very different material. Man from U.N.C.L.E. too, wasn't it? Didn't he do? So different type of material. And it's not always an easy transition when you are used to doing a certain, I don't know if I want to say genre of film, and then going to something that's a little bit more, fantastical, if you want to call it that. But it sounds like what you're saying is he does a fairly decent job of traversing to this.
Yeah, I wrote a lot about that for Esquire. Actually, it's out today. And what's funny is Guy Ritchie on the surface does seem like the wrong choice because he's so closely associated with sort of British crime films that were certainly R-rated and for adults and about sort of adult material and had adult themes. And this is clearly not that. But, you know, below the surface, he loves stories about, you know, small-time criminals who are dreaming big, who have big, you know, sort of schemes. And he's increasingly moved up the ladder to big studio fare where he works in a lot of computer-generated stuff. He did do Sherlock Holmes. King Arthur, which I think is a sort of a disaster, is a big, spectacular film, though, with special effects. So in that regard, Aladdin does sort of fit into his wheelhouse. I think what doesn't work for him is just that this is too family-friendly. It's too bright and colorful and cartoonish, and that's not really his sensibility. So there are reasons to think it might have worked. I also think the problem is that Guy Ritchie has a very distinctive style, for better or worse, and this film doesn't really allow him to get into that too much because, again, Disney demands the movie be just like the last Aladdin. And so there's very little room for great creative flourishes when you're too busy making sure that the magic carpet rides and the genie sequences are what people want and remember and expect. So, you know, it's a mixed bag.
You hit the key word that I was trying to get to, and I couldn't find it, style. And that's what I was driving at, stylistically. And I'm thinking about in acting terms. I remember Laurence Olivier once said, he was asked, what style of material does he prefer? And he said, the style of material, all that matters is you get on stage and you do what it's requiring you to do. But I think as a filmmaker, there is it's different than as an actor. There is a style that you're used to. And if you have your parameters, your comfort zone, sometimes it is difficult. You know, I can't see James Cameron doing a romantic comedy.
Right, yeah. Some people's style just meshes better with certain types of material. Now, that material could still be a wide range of material, but it doesn't mean it's every single thing. And here, I do think there's a little bit of a weird fit to say, hey, Guy Ritchie, the guy who made all those foul-mouthed gangster films with, you know, crooks with guns, you know, make a fun, family-friendly Aladdin movie with lots of bright colors and, you know, cute animals and the genie being funny and wisecracking and doing all this stuff. It just doesn't 100% mesh. And I'm not sure why they didn't see that from the outset. But then again, you know, Guy Ritchie doesn't blow it. He does what Disney wanted. And in the end, you know, that's probably all that was required and all that was necessary to make it a sizable hit.
It's our weekly visit with Mr. Nick Shager, wonderful film critic with Daily Beast, Variety, Esquire, and Yahoo Movies. We talk more than films, obviously. We talk TV. We talk Game of Thrones. We talk Celtics and Yankees. Those are his loves. We're going to talk Brightburn. Now, this is this type of film is – I'm a sucker for these. You know, somebody's arriving at Earth, and it's his presence or her presence is going to change the world, and there might be some deep, dark secrets, or there's something sinister going on, or who knows what. But this seems like the kind of film that I would like, but I bet you're going to tell me it's a disaster.
No, it's not a disaster. I think it's more good than bad, actually. Brightburn is certainly counter-programming for this weekend. It's on the other end of the spectrum from Aladdin. It's from James Gunn, who is best known as the writer and director of the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. He's executive produced it, and both his two of his brothers wrote the film. And it is, in, you know, the long and short of it is, it's a Superman origin story, except it's an alternate Superman origin story where Superman, you know, where an alien crash lands in Kansas, a couple adopts him and brings him up, and he slowly learns to, you know, develop and wield his superpowers, which are the exact same as Superman. The twist is that the kid doesn't wind up being a wholesome all-American hero. He winds up being a sort of deranged sociopath with all sorts of psychological and sexual hang-ups. Now, there's a long history in comics, or not a long history, but a sizable one, of alternate sort of Superman origin stories. As I referenced in my review of the film for the Daily Beast, there's a really clever one from about 10, 15 years ago called Superman Red Sun, which imagines what would happen if Superman had landed in the Soviet Union during the 1950s rather than in America. That's sort of where we're at here. This is just imagining a sort of flip side where the kid is brought up in the same sort of wholesome family that Superman is. He's given the values and the nurturing that you would expect to make him a hero, but things don't go as planned. And, you know, the film is a little I wish it had gone further. It sort of ends before I think it should. I would have liked to have seen even more of what happens with the story. But I found it interesting. It's scary. It does have a decent amount of horror in it, and it's actually considerably gory for a studio film. But then also I liked that it was really under the surface investigating the issue of evil and investigating sort of what makes a person who they are. You know, the whole nature versus nurture thing seems very relevant here. And I think the film gets at that in a chilling way while also giving you the goods of imagining what happened to Superman or Superboy was, you know, a terrible, horrible person that you want to flee. So I think that people who are looking for something of the total opposite end of the spectrum from Aladdin, which is clearly not anything like this, we'll get something out of it. It's like, you know, a big budget genre film. It's sort of like a B movie on an A movie scale.
I love the idea of, you know, what if he landed somewhere else? Why is it that these movies, they always land in Kansas or Nebraska or you know, somewhere like that? I mean, Starman, was it Arizona that Starman, you know, what if Starman would have landed in, say, Detroit? You know, how does the movie change then?
Right. Well, you do have that thing. And that's why, you know, I wanted this movie even to explore that a little more. The film winds up being a little, without spoiling anything, it leans more towards the nurture side of that nature-nurture debate. And I would have liked it to have gotten a little bit more into it leans more into the nature side of the debate. I would have liked it to have gotten more into the nurture side and sort of, you investigated how different environments would have impacted him because, you know, there is a real implication in the Superman myth that the reason he has all these all-American values is because he's landed in the heartland where all those American values supposedly thrive. So, there seems like there's a large potential here to do a lot of funny things. I think people who like superhero movies and are looking for a twist on them, you know, will get something out of this. It's sort of like a clever riff on those.
More coming up in One More Thing with Mr. Shager. We're going to talk about a baseball, kind of a baseball documentary, but there's a lot more to it. It's called The Spy Behind Home Plate, and I'm really interested to hear what Nick has to say about this, and maybe even a little bit of Game of Thrones, looking back on the final episode. Nick, where was Nick at with it? Did Nick like it? Was Nick in the legions of pitchfork folks that just didn't like it? We'll find all that next in One More Thing. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
One More Thing today with our very good friend, Nick Shager. Yahoo Movies, Variety, Esquire, Daily Beast. The Spy Behind Home Plate You mentioned to me your review's going up this weekend. I'm going to let you roll this out. I am absolutely fascinated to see this documentary.
Yeah, this documentary is definitely one of one of my favorites of the last couple of months. It is called, as you said, The Spy Behind Home Plate, and people may recognize its story because they made a movie called The Catcher Was a Spy. That was a drama with Paul Rudd and a whole host of other people last year, which was sort of terrible. But this documentary, which tells the same story, is really great. And it is about a baseball player from the early part of the 20th century named Morris Berg, who was known as Mo Berg. And what was fascinating about Mo Berg was he was the son of Jewish immigrants, grew up in Newark, New Jersey, and was an exceedingly smart guy, wound up going to Princeton and then got his law degree at Columbia. But while he was doing that, he was chasing his baseball dreams, much to the chagrin of his father. He wound up becoming a pro ball player. He was initially a shortstop and then transitioned to being a catcher for the Chicago White Sox, the Cleveland Indians, and then the Boston Red Sox. And he wound up actually even managing for a couple of years at the Red Sox. He was a great fielder, a pretty weak hitter for his career. He was beloved by all his teammates. He's this brilliant guy who's also this great athlete, a voracious reader. He could speak 10 different languages. He was this worldly guy who loved to travel. And what happened was, after he started traveling a couple of times to Japan in the 1930s with different Major League Baseball coalitions, he wound up transitioning to working as a spy for the U.S. government, for the OSS, which was sort of the precursor to the CIA. And he became this big spy because he had this great baseball cover. He's a smart, brilliant guy. You could put him in any scenario. He was basically sort of a James Bond type. And as this documentary makes clear, Ian Fleming was even sort of in his orbit during this time. So it's this amazing story where this guy just did these unbelievably patriotic things on the side and then as his full-time career before and during the war. He had all this intel on Japan. He had visited Nazi Germany in the 30s as well before the war broke out. And there are these amazing stories of him sneaking into hospitals and dressing in disguise and going to Switzerland and posing as a Swiss man to, you know, interview and potentially assassinate German scientists. It really is this jaw-dropping story, and this documentary is so great. It has so much archival material, so many people talking about Mo Berg and everything he did, whether it was his colleagues or baseball people. I mean, Bud Selig and Brad Ausmus are in the documentary, among many, 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 many other people. If you're a sports fan, it's this little-known story that really has these wide-ranging implications and is so unbelievably captivating. You sort of almost can't believe, I think somebody says in the documentary, you know, if he wasn't real, we would have to have invented him, because he's such this sort of larger-than-life figure. But he was this very, modest guy. He even turned down the Medal of Freedom that Truman awarded him after the war. And he went on and lived sort of a quiet life afterwards, never marrying. It's an amazing story. I think sports fans should absolutely seek it out.
Well, I'm left with this thought about him, and that's, there isn't anybody on the White Sox that has a more interesting background than him. It's just, as you were describing him, I mean, it's just almost unfathomable to imagine somebody who was, he played 5 years with the Sox. I think he played four with the Red Sox, and you mentioned the Indians as well. He just goes off as he's a spy. How does that happen, Nick? We got about 30 seconds left. How does that happen?
The truth is, it sort of happens, I think, through a confluence of random things where he was really interested. He knew some people. He had spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C. and knew a lot of people. And I think they saw him as the perfect guy to sort of help with, increasing war efforts. And one thing leads to another. And he had this great interest in the world and in cultures and in politics. As I wrote in my piece, as you'll see this weekend, he really does deserve the designation hero. It's an amazing story, really. It blew me away.
All right. I was wrong. I counted wrong. We have another 30 seconds. Quick thought, your takeaway of Game of Thrones, the finale.
Well, you know, I know people hated it to death. A lot of people did. I have to admit, because I wasn't as invested in the show, I think emotionally, as other people, it didn't totally infuriate me. I was fine with it. But I do admit that it was a bit anticlimactic. I wish they had come up with a more thrilling sort of, you know, punctuation. Right. But so be it.
All right, there you go. Hey, folks, he's Nick Shager. Nick, always a great pleasure. We'll talk to you next week.
Looking forward to it. Have a great weekend.
All right, you too. My thanks to Nick Shager, Jill Guerin, our Encore of the Week, Mr. Bob Busser, and Russ doing his usual great job. And all of you folks have a wonderful and safe holiday weekend. And we will say, I'm out of here on Monday. I'm out Tuesday. I'll be back. I think I'll be back on Wednesday. I might have jury duty. My goodness, that's the last thing I want to do. Until then, whenever we see you, you're on your own.